at a certain point, I was almost kind of embarrassed on this one, because it's like, okay, these wouldn't even have been exploited if they weren't putting their management ports on the open internet.
Right.
You're asking for it.
I mean, come on. Like, who's hooking up their iDRAC to their web server just like, oh, yeah, it's cool, man.
Yeah.
Like, I got a public IP on it. I can get to it from anywhere. It's sweet.
I'm Steve Stonebreaker, and this is Ephemeral Security. Welcome to Ephemeral Security. We had a little hiatus, but we're back with two security experts. We have with us the Deputy of Digital Forensics, Brad Lindsley. And we also have with us a man that literally lives in the clouds, Matt Wright.
Thanks for that.
The man with the plan in the cloud.
Today we'll be covering the Cyclops Blink malware. Brad, do you want to tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm a security guy, but I love all aspects of security. Been doing it for about a decade and love to continue to learn and engage in security and talk with people like Matt. So I'll pass it over to him so that he can introduce himself.
Hey, I'm Matt Wright. I've got about 15 or so years in all manner of tech, everything from being a DBA and network engineer to satellite telecoms, and been doing for about the last 6 to 9 years, been doing cybersecurity in various roles. Currently, I focus on CloudSec.
Awesome. Well, thanks to both of you for being here today. I do want to call out that Brad recently moved, and it looks like the room he is calling us from is much bigger than normal. What's going on with that, Brad?
Yeah, I currently moved to Ann Arbor from Chicago and have a lot more room for activities, as they said in some famous movie, but definitely love it here. So
some of you may not know this, but Brad has a cat that he refers to as Demon Cat. Can we get an update on Demon Cat?
Demon Cat is currently sleeping on the couch, which is locked out, but Demon Cat is still terrorizing and jumping up on meetings and still terrorizing all of us. So
Demon Cat wakes up Brad every night in the middle of the night, and Brad has to show Demon Cat the food. Demon Cat will not get up to get food on its own. He has to literally walk Demon Cat to the food.
She's getting a little better at that now that we're at this larger space in Ann Arbor. But yes, Demon Cat still requires a lot of attention and water from the faucet, because her fountain is not good enough. But yes, Demon Cat is still a thing.
I think the cat's trained you. Okay, let's get to today's news. We're going to be talking about the Cyclops Blink malware. This is a state-sponsored Russian botnet that had taken over thousands of WatchGuard firewall appliances in the United States. It's important to note that only about 1% of the total number of deployed WatchGuard firewall appliances were compromised. The reason the number is so low is because customers had to manually enable remote administration to be vulnerable to compromise. So if you're unlucky enough to have a firewall configuration that permitted remote access, you were most likely compromised. And we're communicating with a command and control infrastructure, also known as a C2. But good news, on April 6, 2022, the FBI announced that through a court-authorized procedure, they were able to disable this command and control infrastructure. So the way the malware worked was, after the firewalls were initially compromised, the onboard firmware, that's the code that the firewall runs, it was overwritten with malicious code. And the Russians used something called the Onion Ring Router, also known as Tor, to communicate with the C2. So if you look at it from a 10-foot view, bad guy Russian connects to Tor, then sends the commands to the C2, the command and control infrastructure, then the C2 tells the firewalls what to do. So because the FBI took the command and control infrastructure offline in the United States, thousands of small businesses are no longer running firewalls that can be controlled by the Russian government. They're still compromised, but the Russian government can't send them commands. This particular group within the Russian government has been dubbed Sandworm. They are responsible for things like disrupting the Ukrainian power grid in 2015, the NotPetya ransomware in 2017, which really ravaged Ukraine, the Paralympic attacks in 2018, and attacks against other countries. So first of all, hats off to the FBI for taking care of this. Also, WatchGuard, they were great at informing their end users about this, and they were actually able to reduce some of the infections before the FBI took action, which is really great. You don't always get good cooperation from vendors. So the cybersecurity industry has seen these types of botnets in the past, and it normally takes a joint coordinated effort with many governments and companies to stop them. So based on that summary, I have some questions for our guests today. Should we consider this botnet to be an act of cyber warfare? Could be a stretch, but I mean, being able to launch attacks against the United States from within the United States, from compromised U.S. small businesses, seems like we could be getting to that territory. And I feel it's kind of akin to the Russian military sitting on the border of Ukraine right before the attack, right? They have a loaded gun, so to speak, and they're ready to shoot it, and that loaded gun is in the United States. And so if they were to attack critical infrastructure or something like that from U.S. businesses, it could certainly look pretty bad. First, we'll go to Matt on this, because I think you have a lot to say, Matt.
I do, right? And when you start talking about, is this an act of warfare or something like that? Unfortunately, that kind of comes into a who has what in their pocket that they can leverage from a legal / political standpoint, right? And what I mean by that is if we, as the U.S., right, we see and we identify that they're doing these kinds of things, and it does have like a warfare context, right? So they're trying to use U.S. infrastructure to further their wartime objectives, right? That's not exactly an attack against the U.S., right? You're using our stuff to try and get after someone else. It's there's implications with that. It's not quite the exact same thing. Right now, one of the implications of that is you're kind of making us complicit, right? You're forcing our help, right? We're helping you. And in that, there is certain legal liabilities that can be assumed, right? I'm obviously not a lawyer. I can't talk to all that stuff. So when it comes down to acts of warfare and those kind of things, right? It's kind of a they do stuff, we do stuff kind of thing. Right, especially in the pre-war state. So if you have Russia doing things, or anyone for that matter, doing things, and you can attribute it to them, it kind of gives you more political leverage and things to even go into preventing wars, right? Because you can say, hey, we caught you doing this. And maybe that makes them rethink their capability sets, right? And our capability sets. So that might push the timeline back. Now, obviously, if they're dedicated, they're going to rejock and rehash and they'll be back later, right? But for the moment, you save the day. But at the same time, if we turn around and do something, then it gives them ammunition and political leverage. But all of that falls under federal authority sets, right? So you have Title 10, which is straight up military action, which is, you know, you have your green suiters, as we like to say, on the keyboard, and it's like, hey, that can be an official act of warfare. Right. Depending on who says what and does what and all those kind of things. A lot of lawyers involved.
Wait, so you're saying if you're in a green suit wearing like your fatigues, then it is an active, it could be considered an act of warfare or something?
If you take action under Title 10 and it is.
What's Title 10?
Let's say Title 10 is your military authority, federal military authority sets. Right. So that's like, hey, I have someone operating under Title 10 authorities, which is like, you know, your armed forces. And they go and they're like, hey, we're going to go, you know, take kinetic type cyber actions on something. Well, then, yeah, that can obviously have some implications there, right? Especially if that's exposed.
Yeah. So this makes me really curious, especially based on your background. Like, there's been a lot of gray area in this. What is an act of war from the cyber perspective? Feedback on the Stuxnet version? Like, I feel like that could very easily have been declared an act of war. And there's been a lot of attacks based like on that, like Steve mentioned, SolarWinds. There's a lot of stuff out there that is very, very close. There's a lot of gray area in there. What's your opinion on that aspect?
Well, you're talking about international law, right? And laws vary, well, by sovereignty. So for us, we have fairly good rules that we get and we understand very well, but for others, it's different, right? What constitutes an act of war in one country does not in another. And enumerating all those things is a full-time job for a lot of people, right? But for us, again, you have Title 10, which is, you know, your traditional military stuff. Then you have Homeland Security, which is another one, which is kind of where this falls in, right? And then you have DOJ and kind of DHS and a lot of other people kind of work together in there. But you're not arresting people with that. And then you have what the DOJ has, which I believe is Title 18. Title 18 is law enforcement, right? They're the folks who can actually say, hey, you did something and I'm going to arrest you for it. And then 50 is counterintelligence. So it's like FBI does a lot of stuff like that. I imagine this probably fell somewhere under that, a mix between 18 and 50.
So when it becomes cyber war, is that like something where we retaliate? Is that when it's cyber war?
Well, that's what I'm getting to, right? So politically, at the end of the day, it's politicians that make those decisions, right? It's people and politicians and influence. So if you can arm your politicians with better ammunition, right, now you have an advantage, right, when it comes to deterring war, or if you wanted to advance a wartime narrative, right, because no one goes to war alone. You have to kind of lobby for it a little bit and prep the environment, right? There's a lot of work that goes into that. So if you wanted to go down that route, you need as much intelligence and, you know, really good data and things as you can.
Yeah, this has always been super interesting to me as to what is going to cross the line and be the first cyber war event. Like Ukraine has obviously been Russia's testing point for the power grid and all kinds of attacks that they've done for the last, 5 to 10 years. And Russia's obviously tested the water with, I think there was a Pennsylvania dam attack and a Florida water treatment attack. Like, what's actually going to be the line where it's crossed that is where we change the narrative of this?
Well, now the scope's going to change the conversation a little bit, right? Because now you're talking about warfare in general. At what point is cyber war and, traditional kinetic warfare, which at what point are they going to... one going to trigger the other, right? Because that's what people really worry about is when, you know, a few words typed from the keyboard start ending lives. And the thing about that is they don't necessarily have to be mixed, right? Especially if you look at the way modern warfare has evolved, it's become almost less about, hey, I'm going to go and take control of this territory and things to how can I use, violence to forcefully forward my political objectives. Right? How are these things going to come to a better end state for whatever goals I'm trying to forward, right? And that's the true for the whole, kind of international population. So when you start looking at those things, it's always exciting to be like, this fishing campaign might start a war, but in reality, is it likely to do that? That's probably going to start a cyber tit for tat, right? And that may or may not grow out of scope. At a certain point, you get lawyers involved, right? International lawyers, and you can get things shut down in other countries. And that's usually where historically those things tend to stop. Now, when you start looking at things like Stuxnet and other things where you can start making like kinetic effects based on cyber attacks, now you're starting to blend that warfare space. When you start looking at taking over like SCADA systems and things that control weapon systems, now you're looking at a totally different dynamic to traditional warfare. But at that point, when you start making those kinetic actions, even though you're using a cyber means, you're still making a direct kinetic effect, same as if you had an assault rifle or a rocket launcher or anything else. So that starts to really be that's a hard red line, right?
Yeah, that's my curiosity on this is when a tool like PsychOps Blink becomes something that shuts down electricity grids or, poisons the water. Like that's where I think that the line will be drawn, and that's what's really interesting, and also putting my tinfoil hat on terrifies me.
Well, think about that that Java developer who programmed the insulin machine update, right? That cranked the insulin levels too high and it killed like I don't know how many people. And it was like, oh, that was a bad software update, right?
Wait, was this on purpose or just like
No, it was just an accident, right? But it just as easily, right, a software update or a, hey, I swapped out your run config and now I just denied 911 access, right, to your VoIP systems or whatever, you know, all those kinds of things, whether negligent or intentional, really haven't been worked out from a legal standpoint very well, right?
The MCAS system, right?
Oh, defense systems and those automations terrify me. That's a whole different discussion.
Yeah, we're entering all kinds of tinfoil hat here now.
That's a little bit different. But most of this, when you start looking at your named APTs, especially the ones that are affiliated with foreign governments and things, a lot of that's usually a legal battle more than anything else, right? And unless, yeah, they start making some real kinetic effects, most of it's just going to be financial impact, which is annoying and painful, but it's generally not lives lost and things. So it's for when you're talking about political ammunition, even if it was military or whatever focus from them, that's a hard platform to go to actual war on, right? Because you have to kind of sell a lot of people on, hey, I'm taking all you guys to war because of this, you know, and a lot of those people aren't even going to understand what that is, you know, in the first place.
Yeah, but to that point, those two things I mentioned earlier, the Florida and the Pennsylvania dam, if they would have breached that or poisoned the water in Florida, would that technically be an act of war? And the government, for the U.S. government at least, has kind of danced around this for a while.
Well, that's why. Like, could you go to war on that? Wars have been started over less, right? So could a politician take that piece of ammunition, that intelligence, and then use that as leverage to go to war, right? Maybe.
God, what if you were wrong, man? What if it was really North right. Korea and they're just like laughing in their lair, right?
Yeah, like what if it's a false flag attack?
Exactly. It's a very tough platform.
The Russians would deny it, right? No matter what.
It's a very tough platform to argue for, you know, taking some real serious effects.
I think that's probably why it's been such a gray area for so long, is because it's very hard to prove who actually did what happened. We have a good idea for most of these, but it's still an idea, and there's no 100% solid proof on it, right?
Yeah, for sure. And at a certain point, I was almost kind of embarrassed on this one, because it's like, okay, these wouldn't even have been exploited if they weren't putting their management ports on the open internet.
Right.
You're asking for it.
I mean, come on. Like, who's hooking up their iDRAC to their web server just like, oh, yeah, it's cool, man.
Yeah.
Like, I got a public IP on it. I can get to it from anywhere. It's sweet. You know, that one bothers me a lot. And then, but the other part is too, they just used IP addresses, right? Like their C2 was literally IP addresses. So in most modern like nation state type malware and things, if you look at some of the forensic reports and things, they're all DNS based for a reason, right? Because they can swap out IPs pretty much arbitrarily. And that gives them a lot of flexibility, right? You can polymorphically assign different domains and things and just have them, you know, the algorithm match up almost like a, you know, Diffie-Hellman kind of thing. So it's asynchronously making those locks.
Right. It came out with the capability, right, that the NSA had where they could intercept, right? And they had something called the shooter, right? It would intercept the traffic and they could take control of it. So even if you owned the domain, it wouldn't matter. They could take control of the connection. So maybe potentially they thought that could happen.
Well, that's why you polymorphically you're changing those domains, like even at the top level.
Oh, no, I get it. But I'm saying you reverse engineer it and you get the algorithm, right?
Eventually, yeah, you'll crack that algorithm, right? And you'll have it, but it takes a lot longer.
But to that point, I think that I watched a conversation on the DNC hack that happened. And there were not very sophisticated attacks there where they were not using tools that were using DNS. They were very lazy, pretty much, and they still got in and utilized it and just did it very quickly. So they're not exactly, it's like a crash and burn kind of a thing. They want quick action versus like sophisticated action. They're not sitting there quietly, kind of like the Chinese do, or, you know, North Korea sometimes does. They're pretty much, they go pretty quick, just trying to get their what they want.
Well, for smash and grab, yeah. I mean, they're kind of
right.
Kind of the gold standard for smash and grab. That's what I like to call it. But at the same time, everyone kind of tends to use the lowest power tech possible, right? Everyone's sitting on some 0 days, right? You got a whole bunch of them in your pocket and you're waiting. And you're like, oh man, they patched that one. Crap. Let me get back on the keyboard, get another one, right? But everyone's got some zeros in their pocket, but no one wants to burn them
on, if they don't have to. Yeah.
You know, on ops. Yeah. You just, it's better to keep those for, you know, a real rainy day. So, you know, use the lowest tech possible to get the job done. I think most, you know, nefarious minded folks tend to do that because zeros are expensive, even if you buy them. So especially if they're any good.
Yeah. It's interesting too, because they also, they hit Asus routers too, which they're a little bit pricier of router. So they're probably aren't that prevalent in the like numbers game, but I bet there's a lot of people that have them that don't even know that they're vulnerable to them, that have their, you know, the ability to print over Wi-Fi or the ability to, you know, share files that they have no idea has the ability to be hacked by this kind of malware. And their ability to DDoS or make a botnet of that, people probably don't know it if they're not paying attention to the whole, you know, cyber realm. So
yeah, and whose responsibility is it, right? Is it the customer's responsibility or is it the vendor's?
Right.
Should they be? I mean, I guess we'd have to have a law, right, to make it so they have to auto-patch stuff if it's like a known vulnerability. And we've not got to that point. And it's sad, like, I don't even think that people in the government, like a lot of people in the government, like the people that make laws, fully understand what's even going on, right, on the internet. And for them to even try to understand and comprehend making a law for vendors to patch stuff, it's really sad. I think, what was it when like Zuckerberg or like the CEO of Google was being questioned by Congress? They're like, how come when you type this in, like we get this result in Google? And it's like, they're trying to explain how like the internet works to them and they still don't get it.
Yeah. Good luck explaining firmware to the Senate.
Yeah. So it might be a generational thing. Maybe once some of the old breed die off, it's sad to say. But once that happens, then maybe we'll get some people in that know what's going on. I don't know.
I doubt it, but it would be nice.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's tough to say. I mean, there's a lot of people who are advising Congress who are a little smarter now. So
that's true too.
And then you also have federal, like things like FedRAMP, right? Which is like trying to get the federal government cloud smart and get their old school evaluation systems. You have like continuous ATO. Which I don't know if you've ever worked for the government and tried to do something called an authority to operate, but it is hundreds and hundreds of pages that's collected about architecture and everything that you need to know about that system to understand the risk involved in operating it. And it takes months to get very simple things done and authorized with one of those. So, yeah, between the new cloud initiatives and things and then continuous ATOs and stuff that's looking to modernize those authorization processes, it's getting smarter, right? The Fed's getting better at it. It's just, it's going to take some more time.
Thank you to our guests, Brad Lindsley and Matt Wright, for being here today. Check out the show notes for a link to the Justice Department's authorization to take down the Cycops Blink botnet, as well as a link to the FBI statement before the Senate Judiciary Committee in 2014, where they detail takedowns of multiple botnets. If you like the episode today and would like to help support us, please hit subscribe, drop us a review, or share it with your friends.